from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The death toll rose to 23 in Wednesday's siege in Tunisia, as the terrorist group ISIL has apparently claimed credit for the attack on Tunisia's National Museum. According to various media reports, an audio message claiming responsibility for the attack, which appeared on the internet Thursday, came from the group. That message said the attack was only the start, with threats to carry out similar operations elsewhere in the North African country. Tunisian officials said 23 people, including two gunmen, were killed in the attack on the museum. Tunisia's Prime Minister, Habib Essied, identified the nationalities of those killed as being British, Japanese, Italian, Colombian, Spanish, Australian, Polish, and French. Tunisian officials announced Thursday that 9 people with links to the gunmen have been arrested, 4 of them believed to be directly connected to the attacks. Reports suggest that 2 or 3 other gunmen are still at large. Security has been beefed up along Tunisia's porous borders with Libya and Algeria, and the president ordered the army to be deployed in large cities within the country. Since 2012, Tunisian security forces have been engaged in an operation against the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist groups, which mainly operate in the area near the Algerian border on the country's west. Tunisia is seen as the cradle of the popular protests, which became known as the Arab Spring, after an uprising erupted in 2011 against the former president, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. His removal, however, sparked a new wave of terrorist attacks on security forces, killing dozens of them across the country.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
That was then-President George W. Bush 12 years ago Thursday, announcing the beginning of the U.S. war on Iraq with a massive bombing attack that the U.S. itself named Shock and Awe. In the 12 years since, Iraq has seen at least 200,000 and as many as 1 million or more people die, with millions more left homeless and the country's infrastructure devastated. Almost 9 years later, in September of 2011, his successor, President Barack Obama, said this.
We're here to mark a historic moment in the life of our country and our military. For nearly 9 years, our nation has been at war in Iraq. And you, the incredible men and women of Fort Bragg, have been there every step of the way, serving with honor, sacrificing greatly, from the first waves of the invasion to some of the last troops to come home. So as your commander-in-chief, and on behalf of a grateful nation, I'm proud to finally say these 2 words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home. Welcome home. Indeed, everything that American troops have done in Iraq, all the fighting and all the dying, the bleeding and the building and the training and the partnering, all of it has led to this moment of success. But we're leaving behind a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq.
But the U.S. has never really fully disengaged from Iraq. There is currently before Congress a request from the president for authorization for the use of military force, which is intended for a war against the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
Good afternoon. Today, as part of an international coalition of some 60 nations, including Arab countries, our men and women in uniform continue to fight against ISIL in Iraq and in Syria. More than 2,000 coalition airstrikes have pounded these terrorists. We're disrupting their command and control and supply lines, making it harder for them to move. We're destroying their fighting positions, their tanks, their vehicles, their barracks, their training camps, and the oil and gas facilities and infrastructure that fund their operations. We're taking out their commanders, their fighters, and their leaders. With our allies and partners, we are going to degrade and ultimately destroy this terrorist group. When I announced our strategy against ISIL in September, I said that we are strongest as a nation when the President and Congress work together. Today, my administration submitted a draft resolution to Congress to authorize the use of force against ISIL.
That request and the other U.S. military operations being conducted in places like Libya and Ukraine, as well as recent threats against Venezuela, drew activists to the nation's capital this weekend for what's being called Spring Rising, an anti-war intervention. For more, we spoke with one of the organizers, anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan, whose son, Casey, was one of the early victims of the Bush War on Iraq.
This is why we're in D.C. at this time, because of that, the anniversaries. And I remember we were in front of the White House protesting when we found out that the imperialist bombing of Libya had started to happen. And so, and then, of course, they're in Congress right now, they're discussing and debating whether they're going to vote for a new authorization to use military force against so-called ISIS in Iraq and Syria, when Obama has already said he doesn't really need it because the Congress has already given the president the authorization to use military force. So we'll be bringing those subjects up. We will also be bringing up the subject of the increasing use of U.S. troops in NATO, to destabilize the Russian Federation even further. We'll be talking about those issues too, but cognizant of the fact that it's an anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and that contrary to what many Democrats want to believe, Obama did not end that war, and in fact, Obama is really jonesing to expand that war even further.
2 months after the death of Argentine prosecutor Alberto Nisman, new allegations have emerged concerning the circumstances of his death. Nisman was found dead the day before he was to testify on the 1994 bombing of the Argentine Jewish Community Center. His former wife now says he was murdered by a co-worker in a dispute over money, and that the two were diverting money from the investigation into the bombing to their personal use. We'll have more on that tomorrow. Three former U.S. ambassadors to Ukraine authored an op-ed article which was published in the Los Angeles Times, suggesting that Kiev, rather than Moscow, be chosen as the venue for the May 9th Victory Day parade commemorating the end of World War II. The authors not only advised world leaders not to accept Russian President Vladimir Putin's invitation to attend the 70th anniversary celebration in Moscow, marking the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II, but advocating moving the celebration to Kiev. For more on this, we spoke with Professor Mark Sloboda, Senior Researcher of International Relations and Security at the Center for Conservative Studies at Moscow State University. He spoke with us from his home via Skype in Moscow Thursday. So, Mark, I'd like to talk about the whole thing rolling out about Victory Day. But before that, you know, they had the rumor mill going on over here with President Putin. Some said he was having a baby. Others said he had a stroke. And even some, I think, had him cavorting with Elvis somewhere.
And yeah,
and now
Putin
he's back.
Abducted by aliens, Putin overthrown in a coup, Putin had plastic surgery, Putin is ill, Putin had a love child in Switzerland. Yeah, there was the Western press was in full tabloid mode. I mean, it is such a commentary on the state of the Western press and of its absolutely absurd level of demonization of Russia.
Okay, so another hasn't got as much play here in the United States, actually not very much, but in Europe it's getting play, is the whole whirlwind scenario around Victory Day celebration. Which,
yeah.
Give us the history first of what Victory Day means there.
Yeah, Victory Day, what's sometimes called Victory in Europe and Day in the West. Russia celebrates, I believe, a day after. They celebrate on May 9th from the Western date. Is the most important and sacred holiday of the year for the Russian and most of the post-Soviet people. Americans sometimes have an inflated sense of the role that they played in World War II, thanks to Hollywood, and their contribution was, much appreciated, shall we say. 300,000 Americans lost their lives in World War II. More than 30 million Soviet citizens lost their lives in World War II. That is more than 100 for every American that died. There is not a family in Russia and most of the former Soviet Union that does not have war casualties from what is called in Russia the Great Patriotic War. And it is a defining feature of Russian national identity. Whether you support or continue continue to support the Soviet Union, the communist government, it was a war of the Russian and Soviet people for survival that they won through a titanic effort and a tragic pyrrhic loss of almost unbelievable proportions. So the celebration of that day is extremely important, and we are on the 70th anniversary of Victory Day. And many of these last failing veterans that are barely walking as they come out on old uniforms and with their medals decked on their chest, most of the time so much metal that you barely see how they can walk their way down. Yeah. Many of them will not be alive to see another Victory Day, because more and more of them die every year, and certainly none of them will be alive to see the next really significant anniversary of that date, in the way we ordinalize numbers.
That's an important aspect to this. We're moving into a period. We're at the dawn of a period. That's the first period where the people who were involved are no longer alive. The bulk of the people that were alive at that time are already gone, because if you were 18 years old in 1945, that means you're almost 90. But now we're at the point where the history is going to be remembered not by eyewitnesses, but by the way the history is written.
Yes. It is a day that is usually celebrated in a military parade in Russia, which commemorates the fact that on this date, that in the middle of the war, Soviet troops were parading off of Red Square, literally going into the front to defend Moscow, because Moscow was that close to falling.
Right.
And in a truly titanic effort, that was averted. The Battle of Moscow was won. The Battle of Stalingrad was won. And that began the long, long drive west, which ended, of course, in the liberation of the death camps and the taking of Berlin by the Red Army. My wife and I, we celebrate it every year. We go to Park Pobedy, Victory Park in Moscow. And part of the tradition is to hand out red flowers, carnations, roses, to the veterans. And so we get up early every Victory Day morning, and we go out to stand among many of the vehicles, the museums, the monuments that are out there. And the veterans who are all – they come out barely able to walk in their uniforms, and they're so glad at the recognition they get, and they just want someone to take the time to listen to them for a few minutes so they can tell the young generation what they went through so that it's not forgotten.
And why?
It was a war for survival for the Russian, for the Slavic people, for the Soviet Union, for the, what we consider the free world.
People here aren't mindful of it, but World War II was fought on the ground in Russia, unlike in the United States.
Yeah, certainly, in Belarus, for instance, Belarus lost one quarter of its population. Ukraine also had extremely heavy losses, as did, of course, parts of Eastern Europe. I mean, it was absolutely devastated. They had to rebuild everything, in this part of Russia and Eastern Europe, because it was all looking, pretty much like Stalingrad looked. The history studies that I've seen show that 90% of the German and the Allied European fascist forces that died in World War II died on the Eastern Front.
Wow.
90%.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, the standing joke in even in comedies about World War II, which they actually had here in the United States. I don't know if you had an equivalent of Hogan's Heroes, given the experience of the people in the Soviet Union.
No, there is no comedic take on World War II, and it would not be possible in this country. There is nothing to laugh about.
Right. And here it was that they would send you to the Russian front, basically, because that's where the action was.
Yeah, that joke is very much based in, you know, the reality in, you know, the German ranks, during that time period. It was a death sentence to be sent to the Eastern Front. There was no quarter given on any side, on either side. It was a war of total extinction and annihilation.
So what's happening with this celebration this year?
Okay, because of the relations between the West and Russia right now over the civil war, the crisis in Ukraine, a number of Western leaders have already announced, including Barack Obama, David Cameron, the leader Donald Tusk of Poland, the leader of Lithuania, and perhaps most importantly, Angela Merkel of Germany itself, will not come to the Victory Day parade on May 9th this year in Moscow, as they have done on previous significant years. So this is a, even during the Soviet Union, Western leaders came at times. So this is considered not only a breach of current relations, but a real insult to the historical memory. The recognition of the sacrifice that was made that kept the free world free, made by the Soviet people. And this is compounded by the fact that the government, regime that came to power in Kiev during the Maidan putsch last year, has made not only a huge effort to separate themselves identity-wise completely from the Soviet Union, its communist past. They've banned the Communist Party from their parliament. They've destroyed World War II monuments. You know, they do everything they can to separate themselves from that. But they've made comments, including in Germany, which even the German press was shocked about, where the prime minister of this regime in Kiev, Yatsenyuk, said that Ukraine and Germany were invaded in World War II by Russia. And this is part of an ongoing attempt that has been at least somewhat more subtle in the West to rewrite history, to downplay the importance of the Soviet victory in World War II, and to try to really equate Hitler and Stalin as equal. I believe the word that's used is totalitarian regimes, equal evils, which is, rewriting just the facts of history. The Soviet Union had problems. No one's going to say they didn't, particularly under Stalin, but that was the times. And, the Soviet machine that Stalin forged from what was an illiterate peasant agrarian country stopped Nazi Germany when nothing else did or could.
Right. That's right. There's also in Ukraine, actually, another movement around holidays that evokes the memory of a collaborator with the Nazis and making him a national hero.
Yes. This is part of the heritage of the government that has come to power. It's part of their ideological heritage and for many of them, their actual literal heritage. In Western Ukraine, which hadn't been part of Russia for very long, Ukraine or Russia historically, but had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth before that, Western Ukraine, also known as Galicia, we're talking about Lvov, Ternopil, Ivano-Frankivsk, the heart of what in today is Maidan country. They welcomed the Nazi forces. They celebrated them with parades in the street, They served in military units, SS units, allied with the Germans in extremely large numbers. They participated in the Holocaust, not only of Jews and Poles, in the hundreds of thousands, you know, the notorious Baba Yar massacre springs to mind, but also, perhaps more poignantly, of other Ukrainians, particularly Eastern Ukrainians, Ukrainians of Russian ethnicity or other, you know, pro-Soviet identity. And they were just as brutal in their atrocities and massacres of people from the other side of the country as they were to the Poles and Jews in the areas that they had conquered. This is the Ukrainian Insurgent Army and their most infamous, you know, their most famous leader, the one they celebrate, is Stefan Bandera, whom the Nuremberg trials rightly remember as a genocidal Nazi collaborator. This new Ukrainian regime regards him as a national hero, and the basis of their ideological, you know, reconceived Ukrainian nation state, which makes all of this this rewriting of history all the more obscene. And to add insult to injury, just yesterday, the an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times was written by three former U.S. ambassadors to Ukraine, including Stephen Pfeiffer, who's now with the Brookings Institute. And they demanded that Western leaders, first of all, not attend the Victory Day celebrations in Moscow, many of which have already announced they won't, but that the celebration of Victory Day should be moved to Kiev instead, and that Western leaders should come to Kiev rather than Moscow to recognize. And this is coming to the seat of a government that regards a genocidal Nazi collaborator as their national hero, whom on you know, January 1st, they celebrate the birth of Stefan Bandera. I, you know, 15,000 Maidan supporters, you know, during the midst of the Maidan, marched in a torch-lit ceremony at night that was so intentionally reminiscent of fascist marches in World War II. It completely terrified the people of Eastern Ukraine and led to the, you know, the subsequent civil war, you know, the rebellion and civil war that began when they seized control of Kiev. So all of this, this rewriting of memory, this great, great, terrible insult to history and to the morality of the event has really got the Russian people upset, awake. They're very much paying attention right now. This slight and this insult and injury will not easily be forgotten.
Is it, you know, going to the other theater, to the Asian theater of World War II?
Even less well known.
Yeah, but the legacy, one major part of the legacy there was Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, which prohibited. Yep. You know, basically prohibited them from having a military. They've been skating around that for the last 45, 50 years with a self-defense force, but they're looking at essentially redefining Article 9 of the Constitution out of existence to allow Japan to make war anywhere in the world, as long as the United States says it's okay. Do you see this movement, like from, you know, from Western Europe to the Sea of Japan as part of a whole cloth?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is where we're entering, you know, the post-Soviet era is over. The brief period of American unipolar hegemony when they strode the world doing what they wanted. China and Russia have reemerged, if not superpowers, then at least as regional and great powers that have the ability to resist, you know, U.S. control of the world. And, you know, the attempt to, you know, rearm Japan, the ability to send their already fairly significant military, you know, into foreign adventures along with the U.S. is part of the containment And, you know, the process that the U.S., the so-called Asian pivot against China, you know, and what many foresee as a future Pacific war between China and the U.S. and its other Western allies. What we're talking about, you know, the history of World War II, the role of Japan and everything. And, you know, Americans know very well, the droppings of the atomic bomb. But what they know less well is that several top Japanese historians have come forward to say that it actually wasn't the dropping of the atomic bombs that made the Japanese emperor, the fascist regime, surrender. But the speed at which the Soviet army, when it was, rearranged after the victory in Europe, quickly shuttled to the east and rolled through the heart of Japanese military and the industrial lands in Manchuria. When they rolled through basically the entire bulk of the Japanese army there in less than 2 weeks, the Japanese, many credit that. Rather than the actual dropping of the atomic bombs, which made the Japanese Empire unconditionally surrender.
And China has been making overtures. I mean, they've always had a relationship with what's called North Korea, with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
Yeah.
But they've also been, not just overtures, they've been making big business deals with the South Korean government also.
Yes.
And there's been an entire pushback by China and even Korea over attempts of Japan to do similar historical revisionism over the events that took place, you know, basically the things that Japan did to China and Korea.
The sex slaves in particular from the Korean people is remembered. Let's be clear about one thing. There is a divided Korea today, principally because the U.S. perpetuates the stalemate. They refuse to sign a peace treaty after all of these decades with Korea. They keep U.S. troops in Korea. The North Korean government would probably like to come to some kind of terms and reunify with South Korea, but the U.S. doesn't want it except on terms of a complete North Korean collapse, where they get to dictate the shape of the government that comes out rather than some kind of amalgamation of the two. Because Japan and Korea historically have extremely hostile relations, and that, you know, largely is kept in check only by, you know, the post-war U.S. occupation, post-World War II U.S. military occupation of both countries, which continues to this day. If a reunified Korea was not under complete U.S. control, it is likely that one of the two things would happen. One, it would at least to some degree improve relations with China, which the U.S. most certainly doesn't want. And most likely, to some degree, its relations with Japan, the linchpin of U.S. control over the Northern Pacific, would also worsen. The U.S. will geopolitically not allow this to happen, and that is the principal reason why the Korea continues to be divided today. This DMZ is still one of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous and heavily militarized area of the world.
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, South Korea is still under U.S. military occupation. And if the U.S. were able to dictate the terms of reunification so that it was in a position to dictate the operation of the unified Korea, we would be looking again at the same situation that we saw in Germany with a basically U.S. occupation of the entire peninsula.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, pulling it into, and most importantly, an anti-Chinese, U.S. Containment circle. That is the big geopolitical issue at stake.
Right.
And Russia has very important interests. They would love to see a reunified, friendly. They have good relations, fairly good relations, business relations, energy relations with South Korea and with North Korea. And they would like to see them unified to allow easier transport of goods and energy back and forth between North and South Korea. You know, they would like to have conflict ended, because it certainly doesn't serve any Russian interests, and it doesn't do much for China either.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.